Well, good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Tuesday, September 20th, 2022. We have four cases scheduled on our oral calendar this morning, and this is the final case of the morning. My name is Sarah Wheelock, and I am joined today by Judges Diane Bratbold and Jeannie Cochran. We are holding our hearings today in Courtroom 100 of the Minnesota Judicial Center, and oral arguments are recorded by the court. The audio recordings will be available on the Minnesota Judicial Branch's website within about 24 hours. With that, Marshall, please call the final case.
Our final case today is A22-0221, Joanne Nicola Kinney, petitioner, appellant versus Patrick Lynn Kinney, respondent.
Counsel, as you are aware, you typically have 15 minutes for your primary argument. I'm not aware that you're splitting the time. Is it correct that only one of you will be arguing today?
No, it's not, Your Honor. We do request, with the court's permission, that I will address some substantive issues about the brief, and then Ms. Needham, who also was named in the brief, will address mootness and statutory construction.
How would you like to divide your time today?
If it's 15 minutes, 8 minutes and 7 minutes will be sufficient, but we can monitor that.
Oh, well, what we'll do is... The marshal will work on adjusting the clock, and we will start with 8 minutes for whomever is going to go first. And there is a podium at the center here with a timer on it, so that will be counting down your time. I can also see the time from here. And feel free to adjust the height of the podium as well. There is a little button on the underside. So I believe then that we're ready. So counsel for appellant, feel free to adjust the podium and then begin when you are ready.
May it please the court, my name is Andrew Haugen, and I am here on behalf of petitioner Joanne Kinney this morning. As I mentioned, I will be addressing the interplay between the family law and order for protection issues in this case and also substantive issues with the lower court's decision, while Ms. Needham, my colleague, will address the issues of mootness and statutory construction that are before the court today. In sum, Your Honors, this case highlights the intersection between family law and domestic abuse issues, and moreover, the importance in protecting the interests of victims by ensuring orders for protection are treated as distinct, separate proceedings from potentially parallel custody and parenting time or dissolution matters. The district court in this case failed to apply statutory mandates regarding timing and notice, and failed to also make any findings supporting its order modifying the underlying order for protection in this matter, and should be reversed, and the order for protection should be restored to its pre-December 2021 state, which would have been December 20, 2021. For clarity, the order for protection file in this matter was court file, Carver County Court File 10-FA-21-273, and that is governed by Minnesota Statute 518B.01, which is the Domestic Abuse Act. And then the dissolution file, which actually this proceeding was brought in at the lower court, is Carver County Court File 10-FA-21-290. There are five distinct substantive issues that highlight why this court should reverse the lower court's ruling here. First of all, the modification of an underlying order for protection requires a 30-day notice under the statute. As we briefed, this motion to modify the order for protection, to the extent that we can consider it that, which I'll get to in a moment, was clearly untimely. It was served on counsel for appellant Ms. Kinney on November 24th for a December 20th motion for temporary relief hearing in the dissolution proceeding in Carver County. That is 26 days, and based on the plain language of the statute, and that 30-day notice shall not be waived,
Counsel, just to clarify, the motion that you're talking about is a motion that was filed in the dissolution proceeding, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. And
so, but what is at issue here is an order modifying an OFP. And there, I know in your brief you stated that you don't believe that there was a motion filed in the OFP proceeding, but my review of the record shows that there was a motion filed in the OFP proceeding. And so it seems to me you're making your argument based on the wrong motion, that you should be focused on the motion that was made in the OFP proceeding, not the motion that was made in the dissolution proceeding. But help me out, where am I? Why should we be looking at the motion that was filed in the dissolution proceeding, which actually isn't even in the record before us? Our record is limited to the OFP proceeding.
That's part of the issue here, Your Honor.
Okay. But you agree there was a motion filed in the OFP proceeding?
I actually disagree with that.
Well, our record shows one filed on December 13th. It's in the record on appeal. In the document.
If there is a motion filed December 13th, that may have been our responsive motion in the family law file. The issue here,
it was filed by John C. Little, attorney for respondent. It's a motion, notice of motion, a motion stating, please take notice that on December 20th at 8:30 a.m. or soon thereafter, as counsel may be heard, above named petitioner will bring a motion for an order for the following temporary relief, modifying the order for protection to allow unsupervised parenting time with respondent and the minor children, and ordering that the dissolution file control parenting time and custody regarding the party's minor children. And then it goes on and notes that it's based on an affidavit in support of the motion and proceedings herein, although I will note the affidavit wasn't attached to the filing.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I believe that issue was that counsel filed that notice 7 days prior to the hearing after I had already objected and set forth my client's argument that there was no issue before the court in the order for protection filing. But either way, what I'd ask this court to focus on then is the statutory requirement, first and foremost, of 30 days that shall not be waived. Even if a pro forma motion was filed on December 13th, that was only 7 days prior to the hearing.
And the language you're focusing on is in subdivision 11.
That's correct.
And that's in, sorry, I'm just trying to find it here.
Minnesota Statute 518B.01.
Thank you. Yeah, I have it. I'm just scrolling through to get to subdivision 11. It's a long statute, as you know.
It is.
So that statute, the beginning of paragraph B talks about if the court orders relief under subdivision 6A, paragraph C, the respondent named in the OFP may request to have the order vacated or modified, and then goes on to talk about the 30-day notice that you're referring to. The OFP here was not issued under subdivision 6AC. Would you agree with that? That provision talks about a 50-year OFP.
It was not a 50-year OFP.
Yeah.
Your Honor, we do agree with that.
It's not clear to me how the 30-day language then applies.
I think that's an issue with respect to your question that Ms. Needham is more appropriately prepared to brief within the concept of statutory construction because of certain issues with the interplays in those statutes and how you would leave the court without any direction whatsoever to modify an order for protection if you were to siphon off a later part of the statute referring to the modification procedure.
But we're talking about the notice, not the standard, and subdivision 6, paragraph C, provides that, again, this is a long statute, so
it is.
Finding the language, that allows a court to Here, a motion for modification in an order for protection concurrently with a proceeding for dissolution of the marriage upon notice of motion and motion. The notice required by court rule shall not be waived. So that references a notice in accordance with court rule. You're focused on a statutory provision. It seems to me the two are not necessarily the same. So, again, I guess I'm struggling to understand why we'd look to the 30-day notice provision that relates to a 50-year OFP rather than the notice required by court rule that in this other subdivision 6C.
I understand your question. I see my time is up, so if I may, I'd like to answer that before turning it over to Ms. Needham.
Yes, that's fine.
So the issue here is that even if I grant Your Honor's question and reading of the statute about the 30-day notice and under court rule are two different things. Court rule in family law requires 21-day notice of any motion. There was not a 21-day notice to modify any order for protection in the order for protection proceeding. There was not a notice filed until 7 days prior of intent to modify the order for protection proceeding. There was no affidavit filed with that. So none of those requirements were met either. And considering concurrently just means at the same time, and case law supports that that's as a matter of judicial efficiency, that because of the parallel nature of custody proceedings and domestic abuse proceedings, particularly orders for protection where they may be on behalf of children, that it is appropriate for efficiency's sake to hear both proceedings at the same time or in the same hearing. But that still requires distinct notice, a distinct set of factors that the court is to review a modification of a final order on an order for protection versus a issuance of a temporary relief order in a dissolution. And that's where the court failed here, is that it collapsed the two into the dissolution proceeding, didn't require any proper notice regardless of the reading of the statute, and did not actually address material change of circumstances or any other factors in modifying the order for protection.
Just one quick follow-up.
Yeah, please.
In your brief, I don't see any argument that your client was prejudiced by the failure to comply with whatever notice provision applies. And your client was represented at that hearing, according to the transcript. So I assume you're not arguing that your client was prejudiced, rather that reversal is required simply for failure to comply with the notice requirement.
In light of your question, I would argue that our client was prejudiced.
Well, it might be a little late at this point.
Well, and that gets to, again, the Domestic Abuse Act that I think Ms. Needham will speak to more directly, that protects the rights of victims in these proceedings, and which the court wholly disregarded in failing to apply the statute in any form to its modification.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we will reset the clock to 7 minutes. And counsel, please, again, feel free to start when you're ready.
Sorry, I too have the long statute, and it's a mess to deal with. May it please the court, my name is Lisa Needham. I also represent the petitioner appellant, Ms. Joanne Kinney. I'd like to ask if the court wishes me to address the mootness argument raised by letter by opposing counsel, and if not, I will go right to the statutory construction issue.
Can you just briefly address it?
Certainly. I mean, first I would like to note it is improperly raised. Respondent filed a letter. We were instructed by the court clerk not to file a substantive reply brief. A respondent also provided settlement communications and, more importantly, misstates the nature, the status of this case. There is no final order on custody and parenting time in this matter. A trial order has not been issued. So any framework that says this has been decided is incorrect. Next, I'd like to note that even
if there's no filing in the OFP docket of any sort of stipulation that resolves this matter.
In neither the family court nor the OFP file, Your Honor.
Thank you.
I'd also note that there is relief that can be granted. Of course, the classic mootness issue is if there is no relief. The relief here is that reversing the holding in the OFP does maintain that status quo of the OFP. Respondent could face some collateral consequences down the line. Family law files do not close vis-a-vis custody, and they continue to have inquiries regarding domestic abuse for the best interests of the children. So a reversal gets rid, frankly, of that implicit feeling that respondent met the higher standards for modification of an OFP. And then finally, briefly, I would just note the general doctrine of mootness from In re Tashimi, and obviously we didn't brief this. I do have copies for the court if they need, or I can give you the citation, 853 Northwest 2nd, 728. It's a Supreme Court case, that the appellate courts approach mootness with a flexible mindset, particularly if these present issues of statewide significance. And I would assert they do here. This is not the only case that we are aware of or that happens that has this parallel dissolution file running. And to not decide this leads to a situation where functionally a person can be an OFP respondent. They can voluntarily agree to the findings, so there's no criminal findings. They can then open a dissolution file, slide over to the dissolution file, and get their custody and parenting time modified in that file under a different standard. There is a standard for mootness that it be ably briefed. Obviously, we don't meet that standard, nor does respondent, and I will concede that. But of course, we could not have briefed it. So I would ask your honors to consider this and acknowledge that it is not moot. Turning to the statutory construction argument, and Mr. Hogan addressed some of those problems. These are best understood on brief, I think, because you have to read parts of the statute, and so I apologize for that. But Judge Cochran, you had talked about that 518.01.11b refers only to the 50-year. And our argument is that it does not, because a reading that leaves every other OFP out essentially guts the purpose of the Domestic Abuse Act and the procedural protections for everyone involved. So if we turn to sort of the natural and obvious reading, again, any other reading where the whole of 11B only applies to that 50-year means that the legislature somehow intended to provide no guidance for modification for the bulk of OFPs. And that guidance is key for everyone.
Well, I appreciate your argument, but there is paragraph A that talks about, there's a separate provision that talks about upon application notice to all parties and hearing, the court may modify the terms of an existing order for protection. And I recognize that doesn't articulate a standard to be applied, and I realize that's, the basis for your argument that B should apply in terms of identifying the standard, but I guess what I'm wondering about is if you read B as a whole, the last sentence says, if the court finds that respondent named in the order for protection has not met the burden of proof, the court shall deny the request and no request may be made to vacate or modify the order for protection until 5 years have elapsed from the date of denial. So to read that provision, if you read B as a whole, it really does seem to be talking about these 50-year OFPs. And wouldn't it be reasonable to read A to be applying to other motions to modify, but also read in that material change standard to A, just as, in case law, the court read in a preponderance of evidence standard?
Correct. The court read the preponderance of evidence standard in, which only comes up if you acknowledge that 11B has some meaning. Obviously, yeah. We've briefed the notion of ambiguity, and I would argue that 11A becomes the possible ambiguity read together with the second sentence in 11B, application for relief under this subdivision. But what I'd want to spend just my brief remaining time on is, again, and Mr. Hogan addressed this, absent this statute, it's a free-for-all. You don't have to give any notice. You could give a day's notice. Courts may choose to modify with no rules whatsoever as to how they modify. And the legislature, in providing both effective protection for victims and effective due process protections for OFP respondents, cannot have intended that there is no procedure whatsoever for those possible modifications. So with that, we would ask that the court reverse the modification of the OFP and return it to the December 2021 standard.
Counsel, I have one more question for you, and the other judges may have additional questions. But, you know, the district court's OFP order, I have it here, I just have to find it. It, as you note in your brief, does not clearly identify the grounds for the modification. It references C, the family law court file, right?
Correct.
The dissolution court file. And so would remand make sense here to give the court a chance to explain the basis for its modification?
Typically, I would say yes. In this instance, I would say no for a couple of reasons. First, our argument is it was never properly before the court because of the notice provision. But even if we grant that it was, if you look at the transcript, there's no argument made regarding the OFP. There's an in-passing thing where he says, I think he's committed no further crimes. The rest of the transcript and the original affidavit in the case focus only on the best interest test for the children. So to the extent it would have to go down, I believe it has to go down, and respondent is free to make a new motion on the OFP, but there's simply not an argument that was made either on affidavit or at the motion hearing that would allow for OFP findings in any meaningful way.
Any further questions?
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Seeing none, I just want to say thank you for your argument today. Thank you for the briefing as well. We will take this case under advisement, and we will issue an opinion within the statutory time frame.
Thank you.
And with that, we are adjourned for today.